Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us. My name is Mustafa Akyol, and I'm a senior fellow at the Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity at the Cato Institute. And today, with two expert scholars, I'm here to discuss China's new authoritarian ideology. Why discuss this matter? Because China today is not merely a rising superpower, but also an authoritarian one, presenting an alternative and challenge to liberal democracy. Yet, what exactly is the ideology of this authoritarian model? Is it communism, as we know from the past century? Or is it a new synthesis with a strong dose of communism, nationalism, and statism? How does Mao and Carl Schmitt come together here? And how does it influence Chinese intellectuals? How does it play out regarding the brutal takeover of Hong Kong and the almost genocidal persecution of the Uyghurs? I will ask these questions to two expert scholars who are following this issue very closely. Timothy Cheek, Professor of Chinese Research at the University of British Columbia. Good morning, Timothy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And Lynette Ong, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Toronto. Good morning, Lynette, as well. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mustafa, and good morning, everyone.
Thank you. We want to have a lively discussion, leaving ample time for the questions and comments from the audience, which you may share through our website or social media. Now, Lynette, allow me to begin with you. There was an expectation two decades ago, among Western intellectuals, scholars, that China was economically opening up, so this would lead to the rise of a middle class, and therefore this would lead to democratization and liberalization, and things were looking more positive. Although there were some scholars who raised concerns, one of them, I should honor him, you know, Roger Pilon, one of our colleagues at the Cato Institute, who was a bit more skeptical about China's direction back in 1997. But today we're at a different point. Do you think that expectation that China would democratize and liberalize was just too optimistic, and we are today on the track of a more permanent authoritarianism in China, at least in the foreseeable future? What do you think about that?
In the last 40 years, when one of them, the first of them would be 1989. I think after the Tiananmen incident domestically, that provoked a lot of internal reflection among the central leadership. And at the same time, you have the collapse of the Berlin Wall, as well as the dissolution of the Soviet bloc. And I think that has prompted the party to devote a lot of resources into studying the ideology and how do they then just justify the ideology in order to strengthen party's control on the society. And in 2001, a lot of Western democracies then welcomed China to join the WTO on the premise that free trade will then prop open and make China more politically liberal one day. I think that has proved to be a bit of a pipe dream. You have increased prosperity in China, but then that also allows the government to increase its stranglehold on the society instead of relaxing its control. But then looking forward, one cannot rule out radical changes. I think largely because what happened in China in the last couple of years, there has been a lot of changes politically. And, you know, one could even speculate that they might be implosion or structural changes of some sort that we would see before we see any meaningful political liberalization.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that. And Tim, let me ask you the same question and also remind that, I mean, you are a very close observer of China, not just the politics of it, but the ideology of the regime. Your work was highlighted by the New York Times recently in an article that explains why Carl Schmitt is becoming popular in China, you know, the notorious ideologue which gave rise to Nazism in Germany in the 1930s. I recently read one of your very brilliant articles, Make China Marxist Again. So, but you're explaining that this is a different kind of Marxism. So First of all, do you think that this is authoritarian for the foreseeable future? Plus, what is the ideology of this? I mean, in your definition, because that's something you really have watched very closely.
Thank you, Mustafa. On your initial question on whether it was ill-conceived to think that China would democratize based on coming into the WTO and being part of the international trade regime, I think there's two caveats. One is, in the West, I don't think my European colleagues were quite as hopeful of the wonderful birth of democracy in China based on free markets. The specialist that I talked to said, what we're looking for is China to be a responsible actor in the international regime, which includes the market economy. And we've gotten some of that, but we've gotten some geopolitical actions that are not responsible and that are not good. On the other hand, inside China and on the ideological side, as we'll be talking about today, this authoritarianism, this ideological governance is not new, but under Jiang Zemin, it was very much looser. And inside China, I know of party intellectuals who thought there was a chance that there would be a more liberal version of Leninism. And that collapsed into the more authoritarian view that we're seeing now a year or two before Xi Jinping came to power at the end of the Hu Jintao administration. The long and the short of it is this ideology that we're all confronting is not new. It is ideological governance. It started with Sun Yat-sen in the 1920s. Chiang Kai-shek pushed it. If you read his China's Destiny book from 1944, it's all in there. And Mao Zedong did it, and Deng Xiaoping did it, and now Xi Jinping is reasserting it. So for those who have been watching China for a long time, this is unfortunately not a surprise.
So to follow up on that, where does Carl Schmitt come into the picture? Because that's really interesting for me, and there was a long article about that in the New York Times a while ago. Because we know Maoism is the official ideology of China, and still Maoism is there, and Mao is highly revered, and actually there's a rebirth of that. But then there is this new popularity of Carl Schmitt, and of course people who know the history of political thought will immediately recognize that's the immediate red flag, because Carl Schmitt is the quintessential anti-liberal ideologue, you know, and like refuting every basic premise of liberalism, that is in the classical sense, like that is individual rights and state supremacy, the perception of politics as between enemy and friend. So why did he become popular, and did he become popular in China among Chinese intellectuals today?
Lynette?
For you too. First two, and then I'll go back to Lina.
Okie dokie. Just trying to be balanced. Carl Schmitt has become popular amongst the establishment intellectuals in China who are trying to articulate the statist view and why it's a good thing to have party domination of society. We view party domination as a bad thing. The Communist Party views it as a good thing because they feel they're the only people with the scientific training and management skills to take care of the problems that China is facing today. That's very clear in the party documents and in what Xi Jinping has said. The only change we've seen between 2005 and now is instead of a committee collective leadership, we've shifted back to the dictator. The real trick is to take someone as bland as Xi Jinping and present him as a charismatic leader like Deng Xiaoping and Mao Zedong were. So Schmitt turns out to be a very useful tool for the ideological explanations that the China's establishment intellectuals are making about why under current conditions you need party rule. And the reason you need Schmitt is you are no longer doing revolution.
Okay, yeah. That's important. And Lynette, so on that question, let me come back to you now. Sorry, I just had to follow up with Tim with the first question. What do you think, like, how do you define the ruling or the official ideology? I mean, party must rule over the society, they're enemies of the people, and that there's the true people that the party represents. Is it still that Marxist blueprint? What's the role of nationalism? How do you see it?
So this is how I look at ideology. There's a documentary on the Yangtze River, which was produced about 10 years ago. I don't know whether your team has actually watched it. There's this Chinese tour guide who's trying to explain a group of Western tourists what China is. So this is what he said. He said China is like a driver cruising along a highway, signal left and then turned right. Right. So if I could use that analogy one step further, if people would go up to China and say that, you know, you have gone up the wrong lane, China would then point to its signal and say, but you see, I've actually signaled left. Ideology to me, you know, serves that purpose in China. And of course, unlike Tim, who has spent a lot of time studying that ideology, I haven't, and I looked at things from a slightly different perspective. So my work is more inductive, where I go to the field and observe what's happening in China and trying to make sense out of it. We know for a fact that every year the Chinese Communist Party invests a lot of resources, provide funding to university scholars to get them to study ideology, right? And recently there is a rise of a new left, like what Tim has mentioned, a new left among the Chinese intellectuals, really trying to propagate China dream, trying to put forward a status perspective of the CCP rule. And we see manifestation of that throughout Chinese societies, as well as in Hong Kong and other places. But to me, ideology in China today serves as almost an exposed justification for government policies. Of course, there are people who generally believe in that, but it's almost like an afterthought type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Lynette. And let me turn to Tim at this point. Also, Tim, how does the current ideology in China perceive the global scene? I mean, typical of authoritarian ideologies is to say liberal democracy is just a Western product. Maybe it's good for the West, but maybe it's not good anywhere because it's corrupt, because it is not ordered, it's not disciplined. Our civilization is different. Our civilization is based on discipline and order and so on and so forth. And we're presenting a better model. Is there that sort of feeling in China that liberalism is a Western lie that has to be, you know, trashed, put in strong terms? We knew that kind of narrative in the past from Japanese fascists and other, let's say, alternatives that come and I'm not saying China's at that sort of aggressiveness today, but how does it play out? Because I hear a lot of, when I read Chinese documents, this civilizational assertion that liberalism is a Western thing and we don't have to buy into that. We need a more ordered society, and that's what it is. And it comes with a civilizational pride. Do you see that sort of narrative and feeling in China?
I definitely do see the civilizational argument coming. I think it's really important what Lynette said about ideology. And I think what we can do here is distinguish at minimum two domains, the public or ordinary people and the leadership. And I think the description of ideology as a post hoc explanation or excuse or, you know, after the fact is very much the experience of people on the ground. However, the leadership and the people who are running the government, they either believe or feel strongly they must act like they believe in this ideology, and they are recasting it. And so the problem is that the Maoist ideology doesn't fit anymore because they're turning right, not turning left. And the Jiang Zemin period was too loose and contributed to two things: rampant corruption in the party and more challenges from society. And we talked about what is motivating in this new period. For the Chinese leadership, we need to emphasize, and Lynette raised this, the collapse of the Soviet Union. This is a fixation of Xi Jinping. He says, essentially in Chinese, you know, the problem with the Soviet Union is no one had the cojones, you know, to stand up and fight back and save the party. And by God, I do. And so the civilizational debate reminds us of the what we would call the public transcript. We all know James C. Scott and the famous hidden transcripts of popular resistance. I've been studying the public transcripts, which is a chapter in that book people seem to ignore, which is that the leadership has to have its own ideology to keep its 90 million cadres feeling good about what they're doing. And that's what the push is. They're saying, we're not Western. It doesn't seem to be working, as you suggested recently. And we have our own way, and here it is. And the next thing we're going to get is, not only do you have nationalism and statism added to the Leninist mix, you have Confucianism. And they're trying to recapture imperial Confucianism.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. So according to Xi Jinping, president of China, Soviet Union collapsed not because of any inherent problem, but because the Communist Party was not bold enough to stand up against Western pressure, or it wasn't bold enough to defend itself, not because dictatorship is inherently flawed. So I see that point, yeah, very, very clear. So Lynette, let me come back to you and let me ask you this. Did the discussions about the coronavirus and how China handles this add anything to this? Because I hear narratives that, you know, Western democracies cannot handle the health issues in the West, but now China is doing much better. Is it there right now in the also ideology? And that's something we should maybe, we should be concerned about.
Yes. So I think in terms of ideology, there's another dimension of it, which is performance legitimacy. I think there's only so much that, so I think the Chinese Communist Party stands on different legs, and one of them is ideological legitimation, and the other leg is performance legitimation. So here we are talking about delivering economic goods and economic prosperity to the hands of the people. And the other dimension of that is in terms of crisis management. And we see this played out very well during the pandemic. So even though China was the origins of the outbreak of the pandemic, subsequently what it has done from about January up to April or May is, you know, building of hospitals in Wuhan, two hospitals being built within 2 weeks. They have managed to flatten the curve very, very quickly and keep the infection rate and death rates, if you believe those numbers, under control much more effectively and efficiently than a lot of Western democracies could do. And they only need to point to the United States under President Trump and the very high infection rate in the UK, including Canada, to draw that conclusion and to tell that message to the people. So I think, you know, in terms of the pandemic has actually helped to boost performance legitimacy to the population, and it has helped the party in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think the usual argument for dictatorship is that it delivers, right? I mean, trains run on time and things are more ordered and more successful, which is true for a while, but then things go out of control precisely because it's dictatorship. And by the way, regarding the coronavirus pandemic, one can say that China handled the contagion in terms of disciplining the society and stopping the spread. But one can make the argument that the virus maybe would not explode in the first place if the Chinese doctors who were warning about it were not, you know, blamed for treason and silenced, and the news were not suppressed in the first place. So if China had a free press and an independent judiciary. What do you think about that, Tim? I mean, does the coronavirus era play into the Chinese ideology and the authoritarian ideology? And what are the flaws you see in that, if any?
Yes, it absolutely does. You have to have your head in the sand not to wonder how come things are going so well in China in terms of the virus, and not in Europe and North America, not to mention Brazil and India. Do keep in mind that Taiwan, another Chinese society, under a separate administration has done very well as well, but it's an island. But in terms of the Communist Party ideology, Lynette's absolutely right that one of the two legs they stand on, one is ideological purity and appropriateness, and that we're a civilized nation, we have this great ideology, and the other is that we deliver. And for the international competition between the United States and China, or between the Western liberal order and the whatever order the Belt and Road represents, this is a strong recommendation from their point of view. I do take your point, though, that, and we'll see this, boy, it looks great. And then you say, okay, so how about Xinjiang? How about Hong Kong? And then we begin to see the drawbacks of this particular approach.
Well, on that note, then let's start to discuss how about Xinjiang and how about Hong Kong and how the Chinese official ideology play out in these important crises, I mean, human rights crises. Lynette, what do you think? Let's begin with Hong Kong, if you will, something you've followed very closely. Like, how does the takeover of Hong Kong, which has been very concerning from a lot of people in the West and observing human, because Hong Kong has been a very free part of the world. In our Human Freedom Index that Cato Institute and partners publish every year, Hong Kong is generally at the top, you know, one of the top countries. But Hong Kong is now a part of mainland China, basically. How does it play out? Like, is this a conquest that now the Chinese government is proud of? And is it seen as totally justified? Is there any discussion about Hong Kong? Did it add to the ideology?
Right. That's a great, great question. So I'll offer two perspectives. One perspective is from someone who studied, you know, protests. I think China decided to crack down on Hong Kong because protests got violent. So Hong Kong is not immune to protests. In fact, a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, the Umbrella Movement attracted even more participants in terms of mass mobilization. But I think what is different from the protests in last summer is the protests got violent, turned violent, and at times it even turned into a riot. So the dimension of a riot is that the government then loses control over the situation. And we could see similar situation when it played out in mainland China. That often justifies very harsh crackdown on the part of Chinese police and even sometimes the paramilitary or the Wujing. And then subsequently, we see the introduction of the national security law, which really trying to exert CCP's control over all dimensions of Hong Kong society. The other perspective I would offer is that from an ideological perspective, you have, you know, new left scholars, Jiang Zigong and so on, people who believe in kind of status perspective, they would say that, you know, this is a time for Beijing to assert control because, you know, political sovereignty. So they see the protesters as violent criminals, people as separatists, even though the protesters have never said that we want to be separated from mainland China. They want genuine autonomy and universal suffrage, but separatism has never entered into their lingua. But people in Beijing, as well as these new left intellectuals, see them as separatists, which then justifies, you know, putting political sovereignty over the rule of law. We have to crack down on them. We have to clamp down on the protests at the cost of everything else. So again, you know, whether or not the intellectuals and the leadership, like Tim mentioned, really believe in what they say and the ideology, that is definitely the justification that they are using to crack down on the protesters.
Okay, well, that's an important point, I think, everywhere. I mean, if protests in any country, in any context, go violent, turn into riots, they delegitimize the legitimate case that they have. And, you know, they might be giving some chance for the authoritarians who want to crack down on legitimate protests as well. I think we can observe that in different parts of the world. And Lynette, the separatism aspect you mentioned is also important. I'm from Turkey. I know which is a country obsessed with separatism as well for about a century. And Turkey has a Kurdish separatist movement, which turned violent, which is a legitimate concern. But the way Turkey handled this problem has been counterproductive in the sense that Turkey was concerned with Kurdish separatism. So what was the solution for decades? Banning the Kurdish language to Turkify the Kurds by force, which only made Kurdish separatists more devoted, you know, to their ideological cause and made everything worse. So I think, that's important for Hong Kong, but also Xinjiang as well. China has concerns about Uyghur separatism, but by trying to erase Uyghur identity and Muslim religion, they're probably making things worse. Let me take Tim's view on that, and I'll ask you about that, specifically on the Uyghurs as well. Both on Hong Kong and Uyghurs, which one you want to take first? What do you think? Like, what is going on? How do we define, especially the persecution of the Uyghurs? And what does China want to achieve here? Like, make them all Han Chinese or just maybe Uyghurs, but who are not religious at all? Is that the ultimate goal? I mean, with all the camps and indoctrination, what is China's golden dream here?
Well, I think you may have answered my question for me, because if the goal in the re-education centers and with the visits of party representatives into people's homes is to get people to speak Mandarin, eat pork, smoke cigarettes, and drink alcohol, sure sounds like you're trying to turn them into Han. Maybe that's not their goal, but that's what it looks like. The situation in Xinjiang is fraught and awful. And what is similar to Hong Kong is that the party has responded by over-responding to a limited challenge. As Lynette has pointed out, the great majority of the Hong Kong people were not asking for separatism. They're asking for the autonomy that they were guaranteed under the basic law. And the Uyghurs and Kazakhs and other Muslim people in Xinjiang were responding to the promise of being an autonomous region under the Chinese constitution. And we're responding to the great influx of Han settlers. And so, you know, your comparison is a bit more like the Western United States in the second half of the 19th century. People who were there already aren't happy with the new people coming. And the party has done two things. Publicly, it has chosen to interpret acts of resistance and protests and a very limited number of terrorist acts, more on a police level than on a security level, with massive overreaction. And they have come in with the security state that we've all read about and seen. For those who want more details on both what the Chinese government is thinking and what people are experiencing there, as well as what some outside observers think, I work on the Xinjiang Documentation Project at the University of British Columbia at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. And I think your kind people will put up the website so I can advertise that. It's not an advocacy site, it's an academic site to give information. So it includes all the Chinese government white papers with little introductions on them and some of the videos from the propaganda bureau so that you can see what the Chinese government is think they're doing. And then you can also see what people themselves are experiencing and what others have said. And that's the second point, that the government here, the Chinese government, is the Chinese Communist Party, effectively. And they are extending party notions of education and rectification to an entire body of people. And so they're taking, people say, is Xi Jinping a new Mao Zedong? As I say, he's Maoist, but not Mao. You need to read Liu Xiaoqi's On the Cultivation of a Communist Party Member. That's exactly what they're doing to the people in Xinjiang, trying to cultivate them into what the party thinks is a good citizen. And it's a terrible thing to do. It's one thing for a party, but it's another thing to do it to a population.
Yeah, I mean, cultivating people into something that the state has decided is the root of the greatest evils in modern history. So we're sad to see that again. Lynette, what do you think about especially the persecution of the Uyghurs? I mean, camps, forced abortion. Some people call it almost genocidal because of the abortion aspect, forced abortion aspect. How does China justify this? Does the population know about this? Like the average Chinese know about, read about this in their newspapers? And also, I'm curious that China is taking great pains to make sure that it is not criticized by Muslim governments on this issue. I mean, I know, for example, in Turkey, Turkey has growing relations with China, economically fine. But Chinese government officials and media have demanded from the Turkish officials that China should not be unfairly criticized in the Turkish media, which means China should not be criticized in the Turkish media, which has been the case. I mean, in 90% of the media, which is, I can say, today under government tutelage somehow. I mean, can you tell us how Beijing sees the persecution of the Uyghurs and what do they want to achieve? And do they think that ultimately the Muslim world will not care about this and they will continue to have great relations with the Muslim countries?
Well, unfortunately, the Muslim world, I think until recently, you will know this well, has been relatively silent. I think the first country that actually made a statement was actually Malaysia, right? Followed by Turkey and maybe Indonesia very, very recently. So largely, the Muslim worlds have been quiet because they have been, you know, they are in a relationship. They are in the recipient of part of the Belt and Road initiatives, and some of them are receiving, you know, Chinese aid and Chinese investment. In terms of how the Beijing leadership sees the Xinjiang problem, there is recently a debate on Twitter between people who have studied Xinjiang for 30, 40 years and between people who study, you know, domestic security and terrorism in China. They are like talking past each other. People who have studied Xinjiang and culture and anthropology for a long time, they see this as an act of ethno-nationalism. So what Tim talked about earlier, trying to assert Hanness and CCP power into the territory. But people who study domestic security and protest and repression in China see this as a response of the CCP to a terrorist act that went on in Kunming several years ago. But to me, that is a little bit like what happened after 9/11. You have US invasion of Afghanistan and what they did in other parts of the world is almost an overreaction, very much an overreaction of what they see as terrorist issue. And we know that, you know, by building concentration camps and what they did to women in Xinjiang, it doesn't actually help to solve the problem, right? So you have very moderate Xinjiang intellectuals. What's his name? Ilam Toti, who has been thrown into jail many years ago. And what he said was something like, we need to listen to moderate voices of Xinjiang population out there. Because once you silence the moderate voices, the radical voices want to be heard. And I think the Terrorism Act is a direct result of silencing the moderate voices, and hence you get radical terrorism.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same story. I mean, the more authoritarian you are, the more counterproductive you are. And actually, you just make the threat you are fighting bigger and bigger, which we have seen in Western foreign policy sometimes towards the Middle East, Western dictatorships towards violent groups in their own societies. And now we're seeing in China. Now, we have also a lot of questions. I want to get to them as well. People are asking very interesting questions through online. But before that, let's also speak about what the Western policy should be regarding China. It's an authoritarian state. It is assertive. It is presenting an alternative model that is liberal, alternative to liberal democracy, which is a concern for human freedom and human rights everywhere. Plus, it is selling this model to countries that are actually interested in this model. And with the takeover of Hong Kong, China is becoming more assertive. But how should the West respond? Because we know any response can be counterproductive, as we're describing regarding the China's response to terrorism, minor acts of terrorism in Xinjiang. The West policy, the Western policy, the policy of the United States should not be counterproductive as well. So in that sense, What is the right way? Tim, let me begin with you, if you will. What would you advise? I mean, if a government, if the U.S. government or Canadian government, you know, consults you on this, which I think they should, what would you tell them?
I think three things. First of all, we have to engage China, but it has to be a practical and pragmatic engagement that recognizes that the Chinese government is a Leninist regime and does not play by our rules. So how do you play if you have to play with another team, against another team or with another team, and they don't play by the rules? What do you do? The second thing is multilateral cooperation. The liberal countries need to get together, need to work together much more closely. China has demonstrated unequivocally a diplomacy of punishment. They've extended it to Canada. They've done it before to Sweden and to Norway and other South Korea and others. And of course, Taiwan's getting it big time. So there needs to be, we've all heard about the united front and sharp power from China. So I tell my government colleagues, we need to have a united front of liberal societies to stand up with each other when one of us gets picked on by China, and to build positive things that we can do that leave us less subject to such bullying diplomacy. And the final thing is that we have to improve our China skills. And so you need more people with Chinese language, research, all those things. I'm now huckstering for the students from our policy school and even the Monk school and other fine institutions in the United States and Europe. You need much. The number of people in the Chinese government who speak English, Zhang Shikong, who Lynette mentioned, is publishes in English. He knows everything about it. He reads the Schmidt directly, right? How many of our policy people do that? So we're flying blind until we get back and build up our China skills.
Yeah, that's very, very good. Thank you, Tim. And Lynette, what would you say on the same matter? Like, what would be some of the highlights for Western governments to keep in mind regarding China?
Well, you know, Tim has stolen all my points. He has said, you know, everything that I wanted to say. But, you know, so I agree on multilateral cooperation. I agree on standing up to, you know, Western, you know, liberal principle, and we have to differentiate it from the values that China stands for today, which is different from it was like 40 years ago. I guess this question becomes more salient today and in the last couple of years because of Trump presidency. And I'm saying this across the border, you know, from Toronto. And I think any meaningful Western alliance doesn't really work, and not very meaningful without US leadership. There is only so much that, you know, EU is not a united entity. Many of them have very deep engagement and commercial interests with China, and they do not want to be seen as antagonistic towards China. And there's only so much that, you know, middle power, I don't really like the term, there's only so much that middle power could actually do without US leadership. So all eyes is on November. I think if Biden wins the presidency, we are likely to see a more effective approach. You know, the US-China competition, the rivalry will continue, and I think that's unfortunate. A lot of us will be pulled into, you know, which side do you stand on. But I think under Biden, we will see a more coherent, less of a knee-jerk reaction, more effective front against China. And I think that is welcoming as well as very important. So actually Chinese people, Chinese leadership really want Trump to win the presidency, because they see continue of US decline, disunity among Western alliance under Trump.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. It's of course important that the US keeps its alliance with other liberal democracies in the world and do not give any credit to the authoritarian regimes in the world. Now, having mentioned Canada and China, today it was on the news that the Chinese envoy to Canada threatened, actually, Canada, saying that if democracy activists from Hong Kong are welcomed in Canada, which he defined as violent criminals, the health and safety of 3,000 Canadians who live in China might be, you know, jeopardized. So that's pretty much of a threat, like a rogue state threat to a liberal democratic country like Canada, which upholds human rights. And I think other countries which are liberal democratic and believe in human rights should support Canada on this. Now, thank you so much. I mean, this is a great discussion. We're going on with some of the questions, and we have many questions that came from people who are watching us. One of them is my colleague, Roger Pilon, whose article I mentioned in the beginning of this panel. He's a Cato Institute senior fellow. He's asking, would you please comment on the public diplomacy efforts of the CCP, such as the Confucius Institutes in American universities, in legitimizing the Chinese system and the government's activities? And connected to this, there have been other questions about whether China is monitoring U.S. universities, discussions there. Sometimes students who are from China are a little bit concerned about what they say in the campus on America might be a problem for them back at home. I mean, if you combine these two things, what would you like to say? I mean, which one of would you like to pick?
Yeah, so I'll offer my perspective, and then, you know, Tim could jump in. I'm sure he knows about the Confucius Institute very, very well. My sense is how Confucius Institutes work in different universities are actually quite different. Some of them operate on the language program funded by the Hanban, which is, you know, indirectly linked to the Chinese government. There's nothing more than that. But in other institutions, they are a little bit more interventionist. They want certain programs and would prevent the universities from inviting certain speakers who adopt an anti-CCP position. So it's really a mixed bag of activities that Hanban does and is activities in different parts of Western societies. But I think overall it is meant to be a soft power instrument to shore up CCP's legitimacy and popularity outside China. But it has really not been that successful, right? Except in some countries, some African countries, where we have seen people singing red songs. At least I've seen clips of that. But I think by and large, you know, in Canada, there's a cancellation of a bunch of Confucius Institute because of a range of problems, which I know, you know, Tim knows about. So there's a lot of effort, but I think there's also been a lot of pushback. And overall, I think the Chinese government failed in the PR effort.
Mm-hmm. Then what would you think on the same matter?
Well, I agree with Lynette, and it was her turn to steal my points. Those were her own thoughts, but we do agree on these. And I think what we're all seeing is something that Larry Diamond and Orville Schell, Larry Diamond at the Hoover Institution, Orville Schell at the Asia Society, had a 2-year-long project consulting with folks on Chinese sharp power, which is this elbow in the eye form of public diplomacy. The important thing here is to distinguish a number of the things that the Chinese government have been doing are normal public diplomacy, but some are not. And so the key is to filter out the stuff that is coercive, corrupting, and covert. And you go after those things, and that's why we have security services, CSIS, FBI, whatever. But I think that the United States and Canada have cultural centers in other countries that are, you know, basically run by the governments, but at arm's length. And so the problem for the Chinese is that, as Lynette pointed out, some of the Confucius Institutes are quite mild, some are not. You can take that a step further. When it's Stanford University, they just give you the money because they want the cultural prestige of having a Confucius Institute at Stanford. But if you're a state university, not even the core state university in one of the Midwestern states, the contract is just shocking. And they're extending party control quite directly. So that's what I meant by practical and pragmatic engagement. Practical engagement would not allow the second thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. Now, we have another question by Robert Perry. He's asking, do you believe China will invade Taiwan before or after presidential election? Or is the current round of sword rattling designed to pressure Taiwan but not provoke the United States? Yeah, how does look China, I mean, probably not an invasion, but what do you think about how China will approach Taiwan in the near future?
Now you get to watch two professors saying, after you, after you. I sure hope they don't invade anytime. And nobody can foretell the future, or at least we can't. But I think the danger is very high. I think Xi Jinping is staking a lot of reputation on this. And I think the harshness with which they've struck down on Hong Kong has impressed me.
Okay. Wow, that's...
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And just a couple of days ago, President Xi Jinping, you know, said to the military, prepare for a war, right? And that sort of, we hear that sort of statement being uttered increasingly in the last couple of years. But I think, you know, overall, the Taiwan issue is like the nuclear option for North Korea. You use that to dangle in people's eyes and then see there's this option that I'm going to exercise. You better give me this. You better give me that. But having said that, I do agree that, you know, the likelihood of something happened to Taiwan has increased over the last couple of years. But by nature, that is meant to be a deterrent type of strategy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's going to take diplomacy to avoid killing.
And do you think U.S. policy will influence how China behaves regarding Taiwan? I mean, is U.S. defense of Taiwan important here, obviously?
Yes. You know, as you know, there's a Taiwan Relations Act that binds U.S. Congress to help Taiwan, to be on Taiwan's side should something happen, should the CCP invade Taiwan. But just the other day, you know, I heard some military analysts saying that the military expenditures in Taiwan has come down quite dramatically over the last decade. So even they themselves do not think that this is a priority. And then you turn that question around to U.S. policymakers. If Taiwan doesn't see military expenditures as a priority, why should we come to your aid should something happen to you, right? So there's very interesting dynamics going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. That needs to be closely followed. And we have a question from Paul Chatham from New Jersey. He asks, do you think it would be productive to engage Chinese citizens directly about pursuing basic liberal freedoms we enjoy to some extent in Western democracies? Could a freedom movement gain traction? Is there any grounds in China to have another movement like a Tiananmen? Hopefully not disastrous in that sense, but in Iran, there's a green movement, you know, in authoritarian regimes, there is this affection in society and which has a potential of changing some things in society. Do you see that in China, or a lot of people are just silent or just, you know, happy with the new authoritarian narrative? Is there a strong current of liberal potential in society?
There are Chinese liberals, but they're not exactly like Western liberals. And there's a range of them. And fortunately, if you want to, the gentleman in New Jersey, if he would like to engage some of those liberals, at least understand what they're saying in some detail, in other words, reading English translations of what they write. There's a wonderful website called Reading the China Dream that is run by David Owenby in Montreal. and has scores of these fine essays: New Left, New Confucian, Neo-Authoritarian, Liberal, a range of Chinese intellectuals. In India, we'd call them chattering classes. You know, and some of them are inside the Beijing Beltway, and some are further afield. And so that's where I think you can see any kind of liberal movement. In fact, liberalism, as you know, Ziyuzhuyi, is currently in the poo again in China. And Mao criticized liberalism because it sounds like social autism. You know, that, you know, it means, you know, it means splitism. It's personal splitism. So we have to be careful about our phraseology, our kifa. And I think if you talk about constitutionalism, if you talk about community rights, if you talk about social services, there's lots of ways to talk to Chinese that will not get them into trouble. And I think that would be congenial to the values we hold dear. So start with reading some of the translations and reach out.
Okay, great. And Lynette, do you want to add something on that?
Yeah, no. So to address your earlier question, the likelihood of a massive uprising in China, like Tiananmen, is close to zero. In fact, I think negative, because the repressive machinery has been so well developed since 1989 that they would likely nip any sort of large-scale collective action in the bud before they erupt. So no upscale, no large-scale uprising.
Okay, yeah, that's what Uyghurs are witnessing and experiencing, right? With that machinery, the brutality of the machinery. Now, here's a question from, excuse my Chinese, Qing Yun Li, a visiting scholar from the George Washington University, and is that he or she? Again, pardon me. He or she asks to Tim, for you, Professor Cheek. Under China's ideology, China is rising rapidly, while Western countries somehow show the decline of Western democracy. Do you think Chinese ideology is increasingly appealing to Western society? Like, this turns it the other way around. Like, it's not whether China was liberalized, but whether the brilliant success of China will be appealing to other societies. I mean, before giving that to you, Tim, I should just say myself, I don't know whether it will be appealing to Western societies, and West is a big and complicated place, by the way, but it is certainly appealing to some other countries in the world. I see a lot of yearnings in Turkey towards something like China, and some of the people who are in power or close to power. It shows that you can be technologically efficient, you can have a high-tech society without all the hassle of a free society and all the democratic rights, and people in power can enjoy, you know, being efficient, successful, and being in power forever, you know, without any threats. So I do see the appeal of China to, let's say, non-Western societies, which are still seeking their way, in which there are some authoritarian currents. But even in the West, I mean, what do you think regarding that?
Thank you. I think it's an entirely fair question. And Mustafa, I think you were right to point out that it turns the tables. And if a fair and equal engagement between Chinese civilization and other civilizations is going to happen, we have to do questions like that. They have to get flipped around. It's not like, when will you become like us? What's the problem, right? We might both change. And so I would say that the promise of the new ideology looks beautiful. The problem is the practice. And I think people in Europe and North America have gotten a lot of anti-communist messages, so it would be very difficult to just go fast. But you look at it, and it sounds great. You said it's a meritocracy. It's efficient. They actually believe in science. They believe in China's climate change. Like, you know, it's not like it's not an argument in China. You know, it's not, but when you look at what happens in Hong Kong, when you look at what happens in Xinjiang, and when you look at China bullying other countries, that undercuts that ideology.
Yeah, I mean, authoritarian ideologies always sound great on paper, right? Efficiency, success, and so on and so forth. Problems and disasters happen when you implement them. Now, we have a question from Alexei Sobchenko. He asks, return to communist ideology will definitely increase government intervention in Chinese economy. Will it hurt China's economic growth? Lynette, what do you think about that? Or Tim, sure, but I ask.
So the question is, increased government intervention, would that improve economic growth?
No, it will be increased. I mean, if this is an increasing authoritarian regime, it will probably have more intervention in the economy. Will this be bad for China's economy? Or are they somehow managing?
Right. So, you know, I think one of the largest bottlenecks in terms of economic reform in China in the last 20 years is stagnation in shrinking the size of state-owned enterprises, right? The SOE sector, the state, the government, the party doesn't want to let it go, particularly under Xi Jinping. I mean, Zhu Rongji, which is the premier under Jiang Zemin, was this iron prime minister who was very good at saying no to people. But I think since Zhu Rongji, no one has been able really to stand up to the interest, vested interest of the SOE sector in China. And that means, you know, diversion of resources at the expense of private sector growth. For a long time, private sector, private companies are not able to get financial resources, they cannot get loans, cannot get working capital. A lot of them rely on their personal savings, which has been a major impediment on Chinese economic growth. There's a Chinese term called 国进民退. So when you have this, you know, this state trying to advance itself in the economy, in the society, naturally the society need to take a step backward. And that happens in the political sphere as well as in economic spheres as well, in terms of allocation of economic resources.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Tim?
I know we're running out of time, but the short version is that I'm less concerned about state-owned industries and more concerned about party interference. And Zhu Rongji, who Lynette rightly brings up from the 90s, he was confident that the Communist Party's economic policies would work. The sort of brittle assertion that you must have a party commissar in every board and company reflects, I think, an anxiety and insecurity underneath the China dream.
We have other questions. I mean, I doubt we will have time for all of them. There are many questions. There is one person who's asking about whether the parallels between, is there any parallels between the no dark corner policy implemented in China, which means there all data is, you know, technologically followed by the government, individuals are traced, whether this can be repeated in America or in other Western democracies. I asked this question to Matthew Feeney, my colleague at the Cato Institute, who's an expert on technology and freedom. And his take was that government surveillance and, you know, government control is a concern everywhere in the world. But at least in countries like America, in liberal democracies, you have an independent judiciary and elected officials, and you have diffusion of power, which makes it look relatively less concerning than the case in China. But I'm not, I'll not be surprised if China, you know, and it does already, you know, exports its authoritarian products about monitoring the citizens and tracing them to other authoritarian regimes in the world, which means that we should keep China, keep following China closely. And thanks to you, Tim and Lynette, for helping us today to get a better understanding. We're coming to the end of our panel. I would encourage everyone to read your articles and your work on this, and we will be posting some of them online. But you helped us, really. And thanks to everybody who joined us. Sorry we didn't have time for every question, but you can still reach our scholars online later. The China story reminds us that human freedom is precious and fragile everywhere in the West and in the East. And there is no end of democracy, end of history that we can say, yes, liberal democracy has become established in the world. Quite the contrary, it must be protected. And China is a good reason to be concerned about this. Thank you for joining us today. Keep following us at the Cato Institute.